Loves the Worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'll be speaking to my friend Jeff LeBay, who, aside from being a highly awarded creative and a highly awarded director, has also been a hay delivery man, a fine artist, and a rodeo rider. So for those of you in what I imagine is quite a small niche who want to know how you go from riding bulls to writing award-winning commercials, this is definitely the podcast for you. If you have a slightly different background, I'm sure there are still plenty of lessons that can be learned in the stories of how Jeff progressed in his career. So without further ado, here's my chat with Jeff. Okay, hi Jeff. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak to me. I think you're in Louisiana right now. I'm in LA, so we can just get into that. So I guess I'll just start off by saying what I say to most of the people I talk to on this podcast, which is, how and why did you get into advertising?
Oh, the how and why. $1 million questions, I guess, huh? Yeah. I stumbled into it, really. You know, I meandered my way through life and different stuff like that. And it just fell upon me, and here I am, stuck.
So what was your first job? Did you start in advertising, or did you do some other stuff before that?
Oh, there was plenty. There was plenty. I have a whole list of things, you know, I think occupationally. Started back then, as you know, probably following the rodeos and, you know, riding a couple of bulls here and there in my lifetime. Then I was one of the few guys going to school. Not really know what I was going to do in school. I kind of meandered around even through that process. It took me about 6 years to get through school, but I got out with a fine arts degree, and then I kind of searched all around. I worked with this little model maker named Yoshi for a while, doing some architecture stuff. Then that led to becoming an illustrator. So I spent many nights, you know, doing illustrations for publications like Road and Track magazine and, you know, all over, you know, the Reporter, just different trades and publications throughout the world. Then it kind of all, art always kind of led into the next thing. So being a painter for a while led into me entering an award show and got some notoriety doing that. And then a design firm hired me, became a graphic designer. That led to, you know, a job at an ad agency called DGWB. And even that I stumbled upon.
How did you stumble upon that?
I was doing a press check, actually, for, you know, I did some packaging job, and I was doing a press check, and somebody was printing some business cards, and they were coming off the press, and I said, you know, it was DGWB business card, DGWB advertising, and I just thought it was the worst fucking looking business card I've ever seen in my life. It was horrible. it had no taste. So I asked the woman who ran the printing place I used all the time. I asked her what was an advertising firm, and she said, well, you know, it's a place that does commercials and, you know, print and stuff like that. And, you know, these guys are in Orange County. So I just took one of the press sheets. I went home and I called them up and talked to the creative director, Wade Kanikowski, I remember, who was over there. And I said, you know, you have the worst fucking business card I've ever seen in my life. Can I redesign it? So it started out as a redesign job. I don't think I ever got to redesign his cards, but cool. That led to advertising.
Well, I just wanted to say the last person I interviewed, she owns a sweet shop as well as being an advertising creative. And I don't think I'd be doing my job properly if I just let the rodeo thing skip by like that quickly. What the hell is it like riding a rodeo horse or a bull or whatever the hell you were doing?
Oh, you know, it's a stumbling period. You know, I grew up in the South, right, as you know. I mean, I live here now. So I think, you know, all that, my dad was always around horses and, you know, and to be true, you know, he broke horses kind of a living and you know, in the summers. He was a young, reckless kid. And I think some of that stuff just kind of fell upon you, you know, when you live down here. And when we moved out to Southern California, I actually got a job like at a feed store, you know, delivering hay and bucking hay. And then, you know, I just kind of always liked that sort of lifestyle. And so the guys there rode, you know, one was a bareback rider named Nick Zabakurski, and this other guy was a bull rider. And so we started hooking up, and I started hanging with those guys, and one thing led to another. You know, and I'm short, so it's like I was kind of naturally built for it, but, you know, in a fun way. You kind of fall in love with that lifestyle. You know, it's fun. You sleep underneath trucks. You go, you know, there's bar fights. There's, you know, it really is as romantic as you can imagine. And it's also dirty and you're stupid. And, it, you know, at 18 years old, I knew a lot of kids who were drinking and cutting up and getting into drugs. And you know, I was never really into that stuff except for the drinking part. And the ladies, so that was fun. You know, everybody likes a bull rider, right?
I've heard that. Yeah, and so did you hurt yourself riding a bull? Like, how close did you come to dying?
The closest I came to dying was actually in a fight where some guy tried to take off my head with a tire iron. You know that thing you take your tires off?
Yeah.
That was a rodeo experience. Yeah, I still have that bloody cowboy hat. He tried to kill me. That was, you know, you don't, it's not like MacGyver. You don't get up when you get hit with a tire iron. you don't get up. It's not like the movies. Yeah, I got hurt. I got, you know, broke ribs, ruptured spleen, you know, every finger, you know, shoulder blade twice, collarbone. I've got some, if you touch and feel me, you can feel some stuff going on there that's not in right places. Every once in a while, when I climb out of a location thing, I kind of feel it.
And that's kind of interesting, this is trying to put a connection in here. So, like, you end up doing a job that requires an enormous amount of, I guess, bravery. And then the way you get into advertising is by telling a guy his business cards suck and they're shit. So maybe this is a theme that we're going to be exploring here, how you kind of do what you think's right and you just get into it. And, you know, even if it looks like it might be a little bit dangerous, is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Ben, you're a smart guy. That's, you know, you're an ad guy. You kind of cut through the chase and kind of probably nailed me to a T. You know, I've kind of gone through my life that way. You know, I think when I grew up, as a young kid, you know, I was really kind of always sick, unhealthy. And so I spent many, you know, in an average year, I'd spend 6 months a year in a hospital bed. So healing and fighting, wow, you know, certain illnesses. And so I got to a certain point where, you know, I just kind of go, you know what, man, you just got to go for it. Life's short. So that took me all the way to 1 year at the Cannes Film Festival and the Golden Drum Awards doing a talk on Don't Be Afraid to Be Fired. My last tenure at an ad agency, I did was invited to do talks at those sorts of places. And my topic was always don't be afraid to be fired. And I think, you know, bull riding kind of equates to that a little bit. Once you're on, you're on. It's going to last 8 seconds. It's going to be short and it's going to be quick and you got to kind of be fearless. So I kind of look at, you know, calling up a guy at DGWP and saying, this is the ugliest fucking business card I've ever seen. Can I help you redesign it? I mean, I think I've always put my heart in the right place with stuff, but I put my bravery out there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So if that's the kind of pattern we're following in your career right now, okay, as far as the story goes, you're at that agency. What happens next?
Yeah, well, you know, DGWP was kind of a cool place, and it was you're surrounded by some pretty good people. I mean, you know, for being such a small agency in Orange County, and we always did kind of cool work. You know, we, you know, it's kind of one of those places. If you're going out to do some work for, we, you know, one of the accounts we had, it was like OP. You know what I mean? Well, Danny Kwok, the owner of OP, always wanted to do his conference meetings on the surfboard. You know what I mean? I didn't know how to surf, but I could stand on the beach and talk to him. But it was kind of like that sort of place where you could also just make stuff and have a good time doing it. It's that sort of lifestyle. So one of the first projects I did out of there was Qualcomm. And, you know, I was a design director. And then I, you know, after a tenure there, I left to you know, another place up in San Francisco and came back down. And then at that time, Qualcomm was wanting more. And they were good. They, you know, when I first worked with Qualcomm, they're a big company now. But when I first worked with them, they were about 30 employees. I was sitting down with this president of the place, Erwin Jacobs. It was a very one-to-one sort of meeting. So, you know, I could befriend them and they could befriend me. And so they kind of, after working with them from a bit, creatively, they came to the agency and they said, you know, we want you to start doing TV. And it just so happened that, you know, I was thrown the assignment by John Gothold, and, you know, I got to work on it even though I'd never done anything. And I think that Fearless came back in. I wrote a film, you know, which is going to be shot on 16 millimeter Bolex, black and white, for a cell phone that nobody's heard of. So it was just kind of cool. I think, you know, I worked with guys there, like really good ad guys. Eric Springer was my writing partner. You know, he's running InOcean right now. He's always done great stuff. And so me and him were partnered up, and me and him have been friends for a long time. And me, my take was always on stuff as on take was like, just go for it. So we kind of made some crazy stuff, and that got attention. And then, I, you know, for a couple of years, I kind of ran the account, and, you know, it got attention, and the main attention it got was Wieden Kennedy. Qualcomm certainly went from 30 people to, you know, 3,000 people overnight. So every major agency was pitching it, and I got an offer from Wieden Kennedy. So that was, you know, my stint in my advertising at DJBB was just about a year and a half in total. So it almost took me longer to talk about it than when I was there.
So Wieden and Kennedy, they pitched for the account that you were mainly working on, and you kind of went with it or something? You were part of the package, or they wanted you to be?
Well, we had done, so we were really, you know, making really nice impressions with the work. It was really brave. It was different. And I think if you know, even looking at it today, it's kind of like you look at it and you go, wow, that's whack for phones. I mean, like, I didn't know what the shit I was doing. So, but it was cool. Qualcomm, you know, they wanted to go international, and then Wieden and Kennedy was pitching them, Fallon was pitching them, and Shiat was pitching them, and one other. I want to say Legas and Eleni, although it may have been DDB. Anyway, all four of those places made me offers because my name was, you know, associated with the work. So, and I was interested, and so why not entertain him, right?
So why was it? Why did you go for Wieden's then?
Naivete in advertising is that I love the work of Nike. I really had, again, really had no clue who Wieden Kennedy was. I really just loved the work of Nike. And I think it was actually Silver. I mean, not Silver, but Eric Springer who said, you know, they do the Nike work. And I was like, oh, really? And I've always loved Nike, so why not? I remember when they called me, the recruiter over there at the time called me up and said, you know, we want you to, we you know, she was telling me the schedule, and Bob Moore and Michael Preve, and God love them, they're good friends. I had no idea who they were, you know, and they're legendary creatives. And then lastly, she said, and Dan wants to meet you. And I was like, Dan who? You know, I didn't even know who Dan was. You know what I mean? I didn't know he was the Wieden and Wieden. So anyway, you know, I was pretty just kind of, I went there because, you know, they did Nike, and I love that brand.
Yeah. And so when you went there, I think you told me sometime in the past about the your salary negotiation with Dan. Are you allowed to talk about that or not?
I remember that was very interesting because, you know, Wieden and Kennedy is, you know, you go there to do the work, you know what I mean? You go there because you love the place. It's an amazing agency. You know, the people who work there from every coast really are fantastic. And I learned a lot there. But, you know, I'm a Southern boy, Ben. So when it came to negotiating, I was just kind of boiling stuff down to brass tacks. I was living in Orange County, and they wanted me to go up there, and you know, and I wasn't making much money. I was just off a divorce, so I was pissed broke. But they wanted me to go up there and make less, you know. And they probably didn't. You know, Dan certainly didn't know. It was probably I was making less because I don't think he gets involved in all of that. But he called me up and what the offer was, and I just, you know, I told him I just couldn't do it. So anyway, about a day later, you know, I get a call from Dan again, and, you know, perfect gentleman, you know, he was explaining to me, well, Jeff, costs less to live up in Portland, and, you know what I mean, it's a great city, you know, I know your cost of living is going to go down drastically, and there's going to be great opportunities, and he wasn't selling me, because he's not really a seller guy, he was just kind of really probably telling me facts that I forgot, and, I said, well, Dan, you know, I was reading an ad week that you guys are getting ready to pitch. You guys are in this pitch for Coca-Cola. And he said, yeah, you know, yep, we are. But anyway, it was, you know, let's call it $400 million. And it was like Fallon pitching and Whiting was pitching and Goodwin was pitching and DDB was pitching. And, you know, and all those places are in, you know, all those agencies are in different parts of their world as well, and you know, Dan and them are up in Portland. And I said, so Dan, I don't know how this works out there, but it's $500 million and all these places are pitching it. But if you get it in Portland, is Coke gonna pay you less to do it in Portland? So he laughed about it, you know, and said, touche, because I just kind of looked at it and just common sense that, well, if it's $500 million. But you're in Portland and Goodby's in San Francisco. Are they going to get five and you're going to get four? No, you know. So, you know, he was a gentleman. He gave me more money. Not much, but enough to go. So I packed up a truck and took off.
Okay, so I guess at that point then you're at what is one of the world's best advertising agencies.
Yes.
Just a little, you just had a little sort of... I guess, small journey in your advertising career, and you're already kind of right near the top. What happened when you got to Wyden's?
You know, it was a transitional year for the place at that time. You know, it was a very interesting point because, you know, what I thought was fascinating about Wyden Candy Event is that, you know, everybody always says this is a young people's business at times, right? It's almost like, you know, that's what they call it. And it, not necessarily so. What I noticed about going into Wyden and Kennedy is the uber sense of maturity in the creative department. And you know, guys who are 55 years old all the way down to 25 years old and legends. I mean, you don't want to be messing with Jim Riswell. That guy could outwrite you like nobody's business. So there's just, you know, as I walked in not knowing anybody, I just, because I've always had such a great respect of creativity, you could go into that place and just immerse yourself. I mean, I remember when I moved in it, when they moved me into corporate housing, they had a reprint room there that went a mile and a half long. Wow. And I took every reprint and pinned it all over my walls. From floor to ceiling to everywhere. I mean, if you walked into my little apartment and, you know, it was corporate housing, if you walked in there, it would just look like somebody wallpapered it with Wyden ads. Because I literally had never done really a print ad. You know, I had done a few, but didn't know much. So I just wanted to immerse myself in it. And, you know, the people there immerse themselves in the work. So, you know, you walk through a hallway of just, you know, really great, talented people. From producers on down. My experience there was unusual. I was first put on, you know, Microsoft, and almost from day one, while he's still my best friend, Ian Reichenthal, I was partnered with Ian Reichenthal, who's, you know, a legend in this business, you know, at least I think so. And, you know, so me and Ian Reichenthal were partnered up on Microsoft, and we had our struggles with that account. The count kind of came and went through Wyden and Kennedy's doors, you know, for a bit. But it was a transitional period with the agency because part of the business at Nike was with Nike. You know, we had just got Coke. So there was a lot of, you know, kind of that moment of what's Wyden becoming. It was always just kind of Nike, ESPN. It was like almost bursting at the seams, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but obviously you end up working on Nike at some point. How did that happen?
Between the night hours of scratching my head and, you know, feeling a bit suicidal, you know, working on Microsoft and not being able to figure it out. And you know, knowing that I didn't know this place other than I love the brand of Nike, you know what I mean? And I wanted to kind of get that into my system. I had this video footage of me and my brother playing football when we were like two in the front yard. And I started to cut it together, and I wrote a little some lines for about at that time there was a lot of athletes who were misbehaving badly in sports, and you know the stories about, you know, playing football with your dad, and the footage was all 8mm, and how he was your dad, he was your coach, and if you ever felt like choking him, he'd kick your ass. Because there's a lot of athletes in the States at that time, you know, really kind of attacking their coaches on the court and doing stuff. So I wanted to write something proactive about it. My savior was a woman named, first of all, Jerry Cronin ended up helping me rewriting it because he was a master at writing, and he did the voiceover. And then one day I was cutting it, and Janet Champ, who I love to death, walked into the room for many reasons. Because she's beautiful, and her husband's beautiful too, Rick. He also worked there, another great ad guy. And anyway, she saw the thing. She said, LeBay, you got to show that to Rizwall. And I said, I can't. And I was bashful and everything. And she said, fuck you. She took the tape, wrote, hey, dickhead Rizwall, check this out. Left it on his desk, and then he called me in there, and he said, where have you been keeping this? You got to go to Nike. I'm showing this to Dan. You know what I mean? He's going to show it to Phil. So, I don't know, you know, went to Dan, went to Phil. You know, there was talks of it being, you know, for a bit about being kicked around for a bigger opportunity like Super Bowl. But I don't know if they've ever ran it or not. But right away they put me on Nike. And so I started working with Chuck and Hal. So it was very much a proactive measure. But really I was just doing it on my own. I didn't really even want to share. I was doing it for me and my brother, really, because I love him and really I love sports. So I was just doing it for us, and then it turned into something else.
So it's a great lesson in being proactive and putting your stuff out there and seeing what it can lead to. And then I guess you're then on the Nike account. And what's it like working on, I guess, what was probably the most awarded account in the most awarded agency in the world at that time?
Oh, man. Intimidating as a motherfucker. I mean, I pardon my French, but I don't know about it. It's again, it's back to that 8 seconds of bulls. It's like I wasn't really intimidated by it. I was just in awe, you know. But because I think I was more or less too, and I think guys who go into advertising, you know, they study advertising and they know advertising. I mean, I know creatives have been doing ads for 20 years. While my tenure sounds long in advertising, it was just 6 years, 6.5 years. So everything's going at a, you know, maybe 7. So everything's going at a lunar pace. I immersed myself in it. I don't think I took a vacation in 2 years. I was there maybe 20 hours a day, living and breathing it. I mean, I think that's what you got to do. And the great part about that place is you could really go into the vault and just watch tapes and study tapes and learn what ads were, you know, and learn how you could find your own voice. So it not only became, I mean, you know, because why you're always making stuff. Yeah. You're always on the road making stuff. Dan Wyden's a big believer. If you write it, go out there and make it. If this from the secretary to the top CD, it didn't matter. So, you know, you come up with it, you sell it, you make it. And so, you know, you're thrown to the wolves. You either sink or swim. So you have to be really brave to work there. You have to be thick-skinned. You know, they don't go around and, you know, cheat. But what they do is give you opportunity. You know, and I think for me, I've always been kind of like, you know, there's a lot of quarter horses. This old analogy, you know, in the South and in rodeo is like, you know, you can have a corral full of quarter horses, and they'll run around in a circle, and they're smart, and they move about, you know what I mean, and they're strong, and, you know, and they keep the herd, you know, they keep the herd together. And then you put in a stallion with him, and he's always bucking, he's kicking at the fence, and he wants to get out. You let the quarter horses out, they work, they run. And you let the stallion out, and it's just beautiful to watch him run. So, my analogy was always try to go in a situation and try to be the stallion. And I don't mean that by try to stand out. I just get antsy.
Right.
I just worked with a lot of antsy guys who just wanted to make stuff. And Wyden and Kennedy gave you that opportunity. And then that led to you learn by making TV, by being on set. Bottom line. And so you ask 40 commercials in the first year.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So yeah, I think we wrote You're So Beautiful to Me. We did. We wrote You're So Beautiful to Me that we did with Frank Budgen, in a hotel room between shoots.
Wow. So, I mean, that's quite a classic ad. Are those guys in that spot Rodeo Rider friends of yours or something? Or
yeah, we went up to Calgary, some of my old areas and stomping grounds. We used to go up to Calgary in the slack days. Actually, Calgary. Well, no, not Calgary. Sorry, Pendleton, up in Pendleton. And so we used to go up that way. So yeah, we went up there. You know, searched down a lot of guys through another guy I knew named Tuff Hedeman, who runs the Pro Bull Riders Association, PBR. So we got those guys from there. Two of them were guys I knew from those days.
And what about using Frank? Was that, I remember at the time, particularly in this country, he was big at that time. He must have done, did he do Double Life by then? I mean, he was big. So was that an easy sell?
No, Sir Frank Budgen, God rest in peace, was not an easy sell. and I think it's because I always used a lot of, European English directors, and I think that's why that's why I like working in that market. You know, some of me and my team members, from whether it be Ian or, Mike Foligno or, just through the years, there, not counting other places. We always attracted ourselves for some reason to European directors. But Mike Foligno actually brought Frank Budgen to the table. And, he wasn't too popular only because I remember Ben Gurelowitz even asking, who's this production company with a cat? Who's this cat company? We're fucking hiring a cat company? Ben Gurelowitz used to be head of production over there. And Ben was always so funny. He summed it up so quick. Why are we using Radical Media? What's with the fucking cat company? And so, I mean, I don't think Frank had done. I think you can quote me on this, Ben, is that I think that was his first U.S. job. It was beautiful.
Right.
You know what I mean? And you know Frank, he's a peculiar guy,
He is, in a good way. And in case anyone...
In a great way.
In a great way.
Yeah.
In case
yeah.
anyone doesn't know what Jeff's talking about, go onto Gorgeous's website, and if you haven't seen it yet, you'll have the treat of your life, and you'll see a lot of cats. So that's like...
Wait, even back up, buddy. In that day and age, I don't even think there's websites. It was like just a cat on the cover of the...
Oh,
DVD
right.
You got shipped to you. That you got shipped to you in 2 days or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think I still have the 3/4 tape somewhere.
So,
and that was only 12 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. The U-matics. Yeah.
Yeah.
You did You're Beautiful, and which other Nike spots like made your name a bit there?
Well, the first thing we did, and that was kind of the transitional part, I think, that I was talking about a little bit, is touching on, is Wine and Kennedy was that, the split of it at Nike and stuff like there. When I mean, the split of Nike, half of it could be half of it there. It was kind of an interesting time because you really had this old school group of guys who worked on Nike for a long time, and then you have this new school. You kind of have two schools in there, and part of it was split. So at the end of the day, it all came together. We did some remarkable work, and so I survived. I survived through it from Nike being split and ended up leaving when it was all underneath the roof at Wine and Kennedy. So that was a major, an achievement for all of us who worked on Nike. And I think even Dan, and I never saw Dan or Dave, I never saw David Kennedy cry. And he was really choked up that day that Ben, Rob DeFlorio came back and said, we're all bringing it underneath this roof. It was a glorious time. So it started off with one of the first things I did, really, that I think probably solidified me within the Nike group, was a thing called Chicks Dig the Long Ball. And while even today, in baseball culture out in the U.S., it's still a major popular line and a major thematic commercial.
So can I just ask what it means? Because I don't think anyone in the UK will know what the long ball really is.
Okay. Chicks Dig the Long Ball was a line written by a guy named Candace Neary, my partner. And it was the idea the grounding part of the idea was pitchers, baseball pitchers,
yep,
who want to become hitters. And what was going on in society, what was going on in baseball that year was that all the big hitters were smacking home runs, smacking home runs, smacking home runs, which we called in the States the long ball.
Right.
You know, they call these guys long ball hitters. You know, like Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa. They were rocking the home runs that year. Big men.
Yeah.
And so we came up with this idea of two scrawny pitchers about the size of me and you, Ben, collectively, yeah, who could throw 150 mile an hour fastball, who want to become hitters to get all the attention. You know, so that was the thing, you know, protagonist antagonist situation, two world class pitchers who decide, you know what, we want to become hitters because these guys get all the attention. So anyway, that was the premise of the whole spot, and it was one of these like kind of Rocky Balboa's sort of thing, skinny pitchers training to become hitters. So at the end of it, they, you know, one of them hits a home run, or he's whacking the shit out of the ball, and he coins the phrase "chicks dig the long ball." So now that ad was done in 1999, and if you watch the playoffs today, you know, the announcers would be going, "Chicks dig the long ball." Their shirts sold, everything. So it was a good feather in the hat to do that, and Candace Neary should get residuals for it.
So how and why then did you move to TBWA? How did that happen?
Well, as you know, shortly thereafter that thing, you know, I was working a lot with Chuck. Me and Chuck McBride kind of became partners, you know what I mean? We started doing a lot of stuff in and off and on, you know. We all kind of bounced around at Wieden Kennedy, and there were really no set rules. Guys there who had coined art directors, you know, write, and guys there who are writers coined, you know, can art direct like nobody's business. So I think it's kind of, Wieden Kennedy kind of runs along those lines as, like the UK, you're a creative and you work in that department. So we all kind of, you know, collectively work together. Me and Chuck started working a lot together. And, you know, after that, me and Foligno shortly got together and we did, you know, Beautiful and some other stuff. And Chuck was leaving and I, and it was maybe time for me to move on after about two. I was there about 2.5 years. I liked my tenure there. You know what I mean? But the place was still kind of going through transitions. A lot of the guys I had come in with had left. So it was time to kind of try something else. And so Chuck was being invited over to Chi at San Francisco, and he, you know, wanted me to go along. And so we kind of went along. I went over there, and we brought in, you know, a guy named John Soto came in there, Eric King, and really, you know, and then Todd Grant, and, you know, collectively turn that thing around, Chi Day San Francisco. So we went over there to work on, you know, Levi's, and kind of, it was pretty much Chuck's ship, and, you know, we were all doing Levi's. I think at that time I was made a CD or making a little bit more money. Chi Day San Francisco was kind of cool because it was almost this annex group of misfits from LA, because we never, you know, it was almost like Lee allowed Chuck and us to kind of, you know, just make Levi's what it needed to be. You know, he was very trusting, and he said, "Boys, here's the keys to the car. Don't wreck it." Well, we wrecked it. We fucking wrecked it. we wrapped it around a tree 6 times. No, we didn't. We made famous and glorious stuff for them. It was a great relationship. You know what I mean? But it ran its course, like a lot of them do. You know. I think we just had this kind of brave courage to make great stuff. And sometimes it was a hard sell, and sometimes it was a passionate sell. You know, and maybe after a while, clients feel like they want to take over. And then you tell them, no, you can't, because you're actually being paid to leave them. I mean, I never went into surgery. I've been into surgery a lot. And I never, you know, I never really sat there and told a doctor what to do.
Right.
So I think I hire him to fix me. So I think, you know, Levi's, hopefully they don't get too pissed, but they hired us to fix them. And we were there to fix them. And we were going to fix them the way we thought we felt best. So again, we were booming, man. We were doing, I think the first thing we did is we kicked out 40 little films with Spike Jonze, you know,
wow,
right off the bat. It was kind of, we were almost making content before there was content. We came up with this idea to film a bunch of people getting dressed in a dressing room, but they had no idea we were filming them. So really, we just rent out a dressing room, put up a bunch of hidden cameras, and then dealt with the aftermath later.
I wonder if
and
you
it was
do that
cool.
Now.
It was cool. I mean, you know, anything you give to Spike Jones is going to be cool, and it was cool as fuck. It was great. So you know, it kind of set this line of make them your own in motion, and then we carry that. We rode that ship for two years or so. You know, along the way, you know, we're working on PlayStation. We got Fox Sports. We won the Adidas account. Then shortly after winning the Adidas account, Levi's called us up and said, "Hey, Adidas is a fashion brand." We tried to say, "No, they're a sports brand," and that was end.
So I think probably your most famous creative campaign was Beware of Things Made in October. And I remember at the time when it came out, there were a lot of imitators. Nothing really topped it. But do you want to give us a little bit of background to that campaign, how it happened, and what happened after it came out?
You know, it was such a cool opportunity. You know, and I'll be perfectly honest with this. Fox wasn't our account. It was really, you know, it was Cliff Freeman's.
Yeah.
You know, and Eric Silver was leading at the time. But, you know, Eric King, Chuck McBride, I think really Eric King worked with Silver at Wyden Kennedy. And we all kind of knew each other because we're all kind of ex-Wyden guys, right?
Yeah.
We met each other at shows, and we all kind of be friends through that world and mutual respect of work. And, you know, I was working with Ian Reichenthal and Scott Patrone, who were, you know, they were Wyden guys who were out of Eric Silver, loves those guys to death. So I think he got the project and he said, "We're swamped. I mean, why don't you give it to Chuck and LeBay and Silver and those guys over there and Soto?" You know, they got, you know, John Soto won Grand Prix, you know, for Nike, you know, and some skateboarding stuff he did.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, some of probably, I mean, not to brag, but probably six of the best guys had the best sports reels in a roof other than the entire agency of Wyden Kennedy. So, you know, it was great. We love baseball. So he called us up and actually told Fox to give us a call.
Wow.
And they did. And we got the opportunity. And, you know, when Eric, you know, when, you know, and you know, and you got to give credit for Chuck with his relationship for Silver. And so it came through there. And me, Eric King and Scott Wild just buried ourselves in it and came up with some killer stuff. It was awesome. It was awesome. I mean, that was a fun campaign to work on because really you got guys that lifted the bar so high and all you want to do is respect them. And you got Fox Sports. You got, you know, the guys at Fox Sports were the best clients I've ever worked with, ever. Neil Tiles and Mark Fortner were the best clients I've ever worked with. They were fantastic. They just said, "Guys, we hire you to make it great. Make it great." And they believed this in, that we love sports, and they did. And, you know, we got what they wanted to do, and it wasn't overthought, and we made it.
Wow. That sounds like paradise, really.
It was. You know, I got to say, you know, that was a paradise job. You know, I don't even think there was a brief. It was like, you know, guys, the baseball playoffs are coming up. Got to do something for it. And yeah, and that, you know, that was like a lot of the briefs said even at Wyden Kennedy. "Hey guys, got an idea. You know, ESPN, we got something coming up." And you know, our guys would proactively write stuff and then go out and get permission to make it.
Sounds great.
So we were always, yeah, it was, you can't, we didn't really sit down and suffer behind briefs. Our suffrage was how do we make it as brave or as fresh or as different or as unique as the guys who paved the way before us?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
So, you know, obviously you were in a pretty good position there and doing really good work. How did that sort of come to an end and why did you move on?
I got that golden phone call because I think I got that kind of, you know, off the record, "Do you want to sell out?" phone call. And you know, I thought it was time to kind of move on. I was there for 2 to 3 years, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, I don't know, you win 4 Gold Lions, why stay? I don't know. what else can you do? And that was just one campaign. So we were kicking ass. So I just said, well, let's try something else. And when I got that phone call, it was like, okay, this is going to be a challenge. You know, you're going from 50 people to, you know, being an office of 2,300. And I really wanted to go direct. So I said, well, I'll give this a try. You know, it's a big company. They're paying me well. I mean, I'm a guy who lives very humble. I don't really like money. So I'll put it away in case I need this money to kind of go direct one day. And, you know, a year to the date, I walked into Leo Burnett. I walked into Leo Burnett, and then a year to the date, they kindly exited me out of there. I was fired.
But at least you met your wife there.
Yeah, I did meet my wife there. I met her there. Me and Cacherie were sitting in our office on the 26th floor, you know, and I had Def Leppard on, pour some sugar on me, and I was standing on top of the table dancing, and Cash had his headphones on, ignoring me. And then Andrea, my wife, she's noisy because loud. She was director of human resources. She was beautiful. And then fill out his paperwork, she left. I told Cash I was going to marry the girl. And, you know, he laughed at me, and we were married a year and a half later. And yeah, I don't know which which is worse, the look on Cash's face or the look on Andrea's face when I asked her to marry me. But, you know, she's a tall, beautiful woman, so
she is,
why
yeah.
not? You
yeah.
know, anyway.
So from there, you moved on to directing, and What was your path there? Were you looking for a particular production company to work with, or particular kinds of scripts, or how did that happen?
You know, I think with Leo Burnett, you know, in mentioning them a little bit, is that was a good lesson in a weird way, because, you know, I really got to, you know, I was there, I was coming off doing 40 to 60 films a year, learning a lot, you know, learning more how to shoot and make things and being on set, and then Leo Burnett, it just turned into, and it, you know, and that just happens sometimes at places, you know,
yeah.
The brakes went on and, you know, you find yourself like that the analogy again of being that wild stallion that you got to get out and make stuff. I mean, I rule bulls. If you put me in a room too long, I'm going to get upset. I'm going to start moving around. I'm going to get fidgety. I want to do something. I want to make something, you know? And so I had to be going. So with Leo Burnett, quickly became the illusion that, you know, I'm out of here. I'm not right for the place. But I learned a lot. I kind of learned through that process the temperament that you have to deal with, you know, when it comes to real agencies at times, when you come to real, you know, real situations, typical advertising. Because let's face it, I was really raised in advertising in a bit. I worked at advertising places, but not typical, not the majority of sort of places.
Yeah.
When you think of Wide and Shide and how they, and DJWB and how the clients you served and how they ran themselves, you know. So I walked out of there learning this sort of, taking it into my hand, okay, I got to get back on. I'm antsy to make stuff. So I took that knowledge and, you know, and God bless Leo Burnett. They were one of the first few people that actually came to me and said, you know what, Jeff, we're going to give you X amount for this, and you're building yourself. And so I said, I'll put in some money. So I then started getting real legitimate work and then shopping it to production companies. Hey, I only have $30,000 to make this for, you know, United Neighborhood Organization, but it's a good cause. I'm going to put in a little bit of money. Can you run it through your place? So that was my birth into directing. And, you know, I mean, it really started with, like, getting jobs from friends, from agencies that were real jobs, and then servicing them through companies until I found, you know, certain fits of companies. I almost directed for a year and a half before I signed with the place.
Okay, so you've had, I think, more than a lot of, say, starting off American directors. You seem to have a relationship with British agencies and Britain as a country. Why was that, and how did that affect the progress of your career as a director?
I never really, you know, for some reason, the States, I got some traction going, and then it built, and then I won, you know, I did really well. You're winning all those new director showcases and, you know, knocking them dead, you know, the Cannes Film Festival and all that, and then I go, boom. I walked into casting one day, and, you know, my casting director also worked with Frederick, you know.
Frederick Bond.
And she said, you know what, Jeff, you're so passionate. You're a lot like Frederick Bond. You need to meet him. So me and she told me he's thinking about opening up a place in, or he's getting ready to open up a place in London, and then you need to meet him. And then me and Frederick went skateboarding one day on the beach, had some coffee, and the rest is kind of history. I you know, got on the phone with Helen. You know, we had a great conversation. Next thing, you know, I'm on a conversation with your wife and, you know, Gabby. So a great duo between that whole group. And then I was in. And suddenly, you know, Frederick gave me some great advice. And the advice was, you know, when you go work in the UK, you got to commit to the UK. And I said, I can do that. You know, I can do that. I'm all in. And next thing was, you know, I got the very first job that Gabby called me up with was something for BBC. And it was with Joe D'Souza and Sam Walker. Yeah. Out of Fallon. You know, good guys, great guys. Yeah, yeah. I remember me and Helen and Sam and Joe sitting in a room. I mean, Sam and Joe sitting in a room and all four of us going, how are we going to pull this off for the best bang for the buck? Because, you know, that day and age, BBC was all, they did all their stuff through Red Bee Media.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of a loan out, but then Sonny really wanted to protect me. So, you know what I mean? What I wanted and wanted to get out of this thing. So a collective forces between, you know, all those guys at Sonny and, you know, Joe and Sam. And, you know, we just started trying to pull as many forces as we could together to do a bang out job. And I remember sitting down with, the telling part for me of when I wanted to commit to the UK was the client actually looked at me in the pre-pro and said, Jeff, you know, tell us a little bit about how do you plan on handling the cinematography? And, you know, directing 4 years in the States, I never got that question from a client. And I just said, wow, all right, this is a different level. This is a different level of craftsmanship. And that's what I was doing, you know, at the Wydens and the, you know, Shires of the world. And you know what I mean? So I then it was like, it's like taking crack, Ben. I was addicted.
I think it's interesting because your style is quite eclectic, you know, in the same way that Frank's was, in that you do funny spots, you do cool spots, you do spots for a big range of clients. Is that a deliberate thing that you don't want to pigeonhole yourself, or you get restless going back to the Stallion thing?
Well, you know, it's like, first of all, that's a tremendous compliment. I mean, of course, I thank you. Anytime somebody brings up some, you know, I admire the hell out of Frank. You know, I've admired everything he's done for so long, and you know, he was a real talent. I mean, amazing talent, and a gifted man. And you know, the other guys I like too are guys like along those lines. While maybe not totally, but even like a, you know, a Spike Jonze, I think has some of those traits. Yeah. Johan Kmitz certainly has some of those traits. I remember Johan would go back and forth between things, you know, and Frederick in his day too. I think, you know, I always kind of look at stuff as conceptual conceit first, you know what I mean? And then I really look at it so deeply as like, what's the best way to approach Levi's with? It's like, for me, it was like looking at that piece and feeling myself being drunk and wandering up a hallway. Well, I couldn't literally get drunk and film her, so I couldn't literally make the film blurry. So the idea of, like, you know, 16 millimeter and Alan Kushler's hands with a rim light wandering around creates that warrior world and, you know, the drunken sort of feeling of, you know, pornography or lust and all that, and you really feel like you've been in that spot at 2 o'clock in the morning, and then you can take that hat off and put it on for something else. So I'm attracted to a lot of styles, and I, you know, and I, but I just look at the conceptual conceit first. And I don't know if that's through the years is kind of limited me, because I think in this business, a lot of people like to pigeonhole people.
Yeah.
You know, so, and maybe that's my Achilles heel. Maybe one day I'll focus on something very, very deliberate. But so much of this stuff comes out of, I never really seen a shitty script turned into an award-winning spot. You know, I give my hats off to writers, because it's a, you know, writers and creators, because it's a tough task to write something amazing. You know what I mean? It can be challenging. And so that's, you know, a lot of times, you know, you got to take those pieces of papers and elevate them massively. That, and that's a challenge. But my take is always looking at them and seeing what's probably the best solution. I mean, I've done things from Walter to Bernardo's, quite different, both of them.
Yeah, and so I think maybe the creatives listening to this might want to know from your perspective as a director, what do you look for when someone sends a script to you? And what do you kind of, do you see the potential in something? Do you want to rewrite things, or what is it?
Sometimes, you know, rewrite's a tough word because, you know, it's like one of those things is like, it's a tough word for me to swallow because I don't, when I, even if I rewrite something, I'm not saying, hey guys, I'm creative directing you, I'm rewriting your script.
Sure.
I'm just kind of looking at it and adding to it. What I like to do with things is add to them. You know, because I think scripts can come in on a, you know, a guy at an agency has to write a script to get through testing, has to get through this and has to get through that. And all of his thoughts may be on paper, may not be on paper. All of his dreams may not be on paper. They may have had to been taken out just to get it through focus groups. So when I look at a piece of paper, I try to put those thoughts and I remove all those focus groups. I remove all those strategies. I remove all those fucking planners and briefs and shit. I just look at a piece of paper, a guy, a girl, no matter what it is, sent me, and I just look at what the hopes and dreams of this could be. And so when I look at a thing, I mean, we've never worked together, but I think my treatments are very much how I see the final product ending up. If you like that, then great. If you want to sit down and come up with more and cooler ideas, then even better. But I love that process. The UK process is so collaborative. I think it's sometimes getting less so, but because I think the challenges are even tougher for creatives. But I think that's key, is that keeping the garage door open versus closing it. I mean, you know, I've been in meetings with Wyden and Kennedy before, and in edit rooms when, you know, a Nike client would come in and we'd show them a 60, and they say, "Ah, guys, this has got to be a 90." Wow. And even their hopes and dreams kept you going. And I think this business at times, especially for creatives, hopes and dreams can be lost. So I try to be that guy who can kind of just go, come on, guys, let's layer this thing. Let's look at the characters. Where's the depth of this? Where's the atmosphere of this location? And how is that going to add to it? You know, I want people to feel things when they look at my work more than anything.
Yeah, and I was just talking to Mark Denton, who also directs, and he had an interesting perspective on treatments, because I think both you and he grew up in a time directors didn't have to do treatments. So what's your perspective on them now? Are they like a necessary evil, or are they a good part of everyone being on the same page when you move ahead?
Treatments are twofold for me, and I think a lot of directors. It's like I really did this talk a few years back for the creativity about 20, you know, directors from Stacey Wall, the Gnome World, myself, Jake Scott, all of us are in the room, and they asked us all the same questions, and, you know, that same question, and everybody was like, off the record, off the record, this, that, and then she said, okay, somebody go on the record, and Stacey Wall pushed the little recording, and he said, I love them. But I mean, the truth be told is that they do two. They make you think about it, you know, the idea, which is great. They make you think how they do challenge you on, you know, how to get all your thoughts out and down. But, you know, also I think I write all my treatments, so you have to remember is that, you know, not all crafted writers. Sometimes my thoughts can, like this interview, can wander and they can jobble and they can go this way and that way. And I think sometimes treatments can be, you know, looked at too literal, and you know what I mean? And you can be thrown out. And that's crushing, you know, because it almost becomes so finite. I think, you know, back in the day, we used to get on the phone with somebody, and I think the treatment show must be the same thing, a talking point. You know, it's a great thing for production to look at. It's a great thing for those guys, you know, the agency to look at, to get a feeling of where your heart's at and what you're passionately looking at. But, you know, when they become so labored and become so analyzed, then it becomes something hard, because film changes. Film moves, it morphs, and, you know, shit. You know, we all know the story of The Shining, right? And you can see the behind the scenes. They were writing the night before they shot. So They can't become pieces of stone for us all to die underneath.
Yeah, I think that's a good point of view on it. And so now you're with Academy. How does that differ? Mm-hmm. Your Academy is your production company. So how does that differ from the previous places you've worked? And I guess it's famous for being Jonathan Glazer's place, or at least where he's represented by it. Does that figure in how things are and why you chose to work there?
No, I mean, Academy is one of these sort of icon plays over in the UK and stuff like that. You know, it's funny because it's like you asked before with Gorgeous and stuff, is that it's really interesting, you know, and I love it. And you come over here in the States and it's kind of a big removal because, you know, a lot of guys here use local, you know what I mean? And a lot of you guys over there use local. Does that make sense? I mean, I'm not just saying local directors, but more localized production companies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So when you go back to the Gorgeous, how come you guys never knew about them? You know, it works the same way with production companies at times. I've always, you know, Academy, when you're in the U.S., you know, I kind of, being in the U.S., I knew of Academy before Sonny. Because I never hired Frederick Vaughn, not for any particular reason. He still teases me to this day and asks me why the fuck I didn't give him a Levi's spot. But it was just that, you know, I met him through a casting person, but I knew of Academy. So it's kind of got like that iconic feeling if you're over in the U.S. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know if it has that to you, you know, living there, because you may look at it another way, but out here, it's kind of known as that, you know, oh, the UK, oh, Academy, you know, and you kind of, some people go, oh, the US, I don't know, you know, they may say MJZ, they may say Smuggler, you know, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting because the kind of what they call in the production business board flow, and, you know, does that ever enter your thoughts? Because the kind of things that Jonathan does may be the kind of things you also could do under certain circumstances. So does that ever enter your thinking about where to work?
First, I would never put myself on the level of Jonathan Glazer, but because they just don't even do the kind of work that Jonathan does anymore, I don't think, out here in the business. You know what I mean? I think the business has changed so drastically. It's different, you know what I mean? Ads are different. They become in so many different forms. What I love to see somebody do, a black and white film of, you know, opening on a man falling asleep and then dreaming of a squirrel. Fuck yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can't replace that freshness. You can't replace that writing. But is that script wandering around anymore? I don't know. But it's different. I don't think you can have anybody do anything like, I mean, I don't think you're gonna have Bernardo's has done some great work. You haven't seen a father come in and slap somebody, but a girl crack, you know, shoot up. Yeah. So everything's kind of changing. You know what I mean? The playing field is a little different now. What brands are doing now and what I get excited about is, like, you know, people used to always say, oh, Jeff, you got to have some 60s. I mean, you got to have some 30s. You got to have some 30s. And I go, yeah, but I don't work in the U.S. I work in the U.K. It's all 60s. And what I love is, like, now it's 60s and it's 90s and it's 2 minutes and it's stories and people want content, and, you know, you're doing things for, like, Bernardo's. It's different, and it's a lot more dynamic, you know. So I think, you know, when it gets in the production company worlds, some places offer that dynamic dimension and some places don't, you know what I mean? So, you know, that's the trend nowadays, I think, is going to take shape and, you know, determine which way directors move around and, you know, and how production companies shift with the paradigm of the advertising world.
Sure. Okay, well, we've come up to around the kind of hour mark. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about or discuss?
Oh, gosh, what do I want to... I don't know if I have anything. I'm exhausted. No, I mean, I got to say, you know, I've been really blessed working in the UK. But, you know, like, back to the day when Frederick said you got to commit to it, I commit to it. You know, I stay there, I stick around, I stay involved. I don't pop in and go wham bam and take off. And I think that's done me well. And I think my relationships there have been, you know, really solidified. And, you know, I know this goes out to probably a lot of people in the UK. You know, it's been a pleasure, you know, to jump back and forth, write some killer scripts. Keep writing them. and know when you come to me that, you know, and I'm not selling myself, but fuck, I feel your pain. But, you know, all I'm going to do is try to breathe life into it. And I really think everybody should write ads that way and live life that way. Because I've been too close to death, man. Live. It's short time.
That's great advice. And I think that's a great piece of advice to maybe end on for everyone to think about. So thanks so much for your time, Jeff. I know it's valuable, and I really appreciate it. And I hope everyone listening has really got a lot out of your unique advertising career and your fantastic different perspective on both being a creative and being a director.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. I appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Okay.
Take care of yourself. I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, me too. Okay. Cheers, Jeff.
All right, buddy. Bye. Okay.
Bye.
This is a podcast that was Christmas.